Last time we were in the middle of talking about the various phenomena in quantum mechanics that are usually thought to be puzzling from the point of view of foundations. So we talked about the first three of these. So just as a summary, first of all, we talked about interference, single photon interference, and we saw that single quantum particles like photons display interference. We can't observe interference and also the path taken by the particle at the same time. And this is the wave-particle duality and is often thought to be a problem for giving any sort of realistic underpinnings for quantum theory in terms of particles moving along trajectories. We then talked about the measurement problem, and the measurement problem basically arises because there are two ways that you can describe a measurement in quantum mechanics. We can use the measurement postulates, the probability rule, the state update rule, or we can treat the measurement device as a quantum system itself and a unitary interaction between the two. If we follow the orthodox interpretation, which is basically an interpretation that says that the quantum state is a state of reality that describes absolutely everything, it's a psi-complete interpretation, there's only the quantum state, then these two descriptions are just contradictory. They give different quantum states. They make different properties real. Okay. We discussed what other options there were for interpretations, which we'll see later in the course. Then at the end, we discussed the EPR paradox, which is due to the perfect correlations you get when you measure a maximally entangled state, two halves of maximally entangled state. So an orthodox interpretation, or indeed any interpretation in which the measurement outcomes are indeterminate before they are measured, for the case of this maximally entangled state, that's necessarily a non-local interpretation. It's necessarily involves some kind of non-local influence, at least if we buy the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen criterion for reality. Okay, so that's what we talked about last time. So I'm going to move on to, first of all, are there any questions about any of that we talked about last time? Okay, so let's move on to talk about the last two. The first one is the no cloning theorem. You may have seen this before. So the idea is that if we have two quantum states, they are neither the same state, nor are they orthogonal. So they have some overlap that's between 0 and 1. Then there's no physical operation you can do that if you input psi will give you two copies of psi, and if you input phi will give you two copies of phi. Okay, so this is basically saying we can't copy quantum states. So why is that true? Okay, well, so as far as we're concerned so far, a physical operation, something that's physically implementable, must be described by unitary transformation. The slight problem here is, of course, that this and this are on different Hilbert spaces. So we must imagine that we take this state, we bring in another system which is on the same Hilbert space. So let's imagine that we have another system which we bring in a fixed state. So this state has no information about whether it's psi or phi. Then we can describe a unitary transformation, and what this unitary transformation would have to do is it would have to map psi tensor chi to two copies of psi, and it would have to map phi tensor chi to two copies of phi. So let's see if such an operation is possible. So the main thing is that we know that unitary operations preserve the inner product. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the inner product of these two states, we're going to look at taking it using the left-hand side here and using the right-hand side here. So on the left-hand side, if I take the inner product of this with this, then I just get these two states with a u dagger u here, so that's going to give me the identity. On the right-hand side, I'm taking the inner product of these two phis with these two phis with these two psis, like this. Okay. So the important thing is this is going to give me the identity. So I'll just get the inner product of phi and psi with the inner product of chi with itself. Assuming we're dealing with normalized states, this is going to be 1. And on this side, I'm just going to get 2 separate factors of phi tensor psi. So I'm going to get phi inner product with psi squared. Okay. So if this is 1, then we end up with this equation here, which says that the inner product between phi and psi has to square to itself. And if it squares to itself, then that means that its modulus is either 0 or 1. Okay, so you know, it could be minus 1, but oh no. No, it's either 0 or 1. okay, so if it's 0, it means that these two states are orthogonal. And if it's 1, it means they're the same state up to a global phase, right? So this contradicts our original assumption that they weren't either orthogonal or the same state. So the point is that unless two states are orthogonal, you can't copy them. There's no operation that will copy them. so let's just point out that this no cloning idea is related to several other key features. So if you imagine that you could perfectly clone quantum systems, then you could create an arbitrarily large number of copies of the state of the quantum system that you had. And that would allow you to determine what the quantum state is exactly, starting with just one copy, right? So what you would do is you'd take that state, copy it as many times as you like, and then make a whole bunch of different measurements on the different copies, and eventually determine what all the probabilities are. And we know we can't do that, okay? This would enable us, for example, to perfectly distinguish two non-orthogonal states. So that's consistent with the fact that we know that we can't determine the quantum state with just one copy. Also, if you consider the EPR experiment, if cloning was allowed, then the EPR experiment would allow you to signal superluminally faster than the speed of light. Actually, maybe I should. Right. So if you remember from last time, the EPR state could be written as, in any basis, like this, okay? So Alice can choose one of two bases. Perhaps it's either 0 or 1 versus x plus and x or x minus. If she chooses to measure in the 0, 1 basis, then after her measurement, Bob's system will either be in the state 0 or the state 1. Okay? And if he could clone, he could create an infinitely large number of copies of that state and determine that the state that he had was either 0 or 1. Whereas if Alice measures in some other basis, say the x basis, the x basis x plus and x minus, then the same thing would happen. Bob's state would collapse to either x plus or x minus. Bob could then create an infinitely large number of copies using cloning and determine that his state was one of the x basis states rather than the 0, 1 basis state. So if cloning was allowed, then basically Bob would be able to determine which of the two measurement choices Alice had made. And in that way, Alice could send a signal faster than light to Bob. So for the consistency of quantum theory, we definitely require that no cloning is true. The other thing is we know that a measurement is supposed to disturb the state of a system. You could measure any observable without disturbing the state of the system if you had cloning, because you just take your system, clone it, put the original copy to one side, measure the observable on the second copy, and then you still have the original copy around. So it's definitely good that no cloning holds. We would have a massive inconsistency if it didn't, but we should explain why. Well, an interpretation should explain why this holds. So if we think about a psiontic interpretation, and any interpretation in which the quantum state really is a state of reality, it's puzzling. Different quantum states correspond to different states of reality. Reality is different when I prepare psi versus phi. So why is it that that difference can't be picked up and copied? Seems a bit strange. On the other hand, if you have this sort of psi epistemic point of view that quantum states are somehow more like probability distributions, then it makes quite a lot of sense because two different probability distributions can't be copied either, right? So if I have if I have say a coin that can either be heads or tails, and one coin has a bias that's a quarter heads versus three quarters tails, versus a coin number two which is three quarters heads, one quarter tails. If all I have is the coin flip itself, there's no way I can make two copies of those probability distributions, two independent copies of those probability distributions from just one coin. I'll go into the details of that explanation a bit more later on in the course, but I don't want to dwell on it too much here, but the point is, if something really exists, then why can't you copy it is basically the puzzle here. All right, the last thing I want to talk about is quantum teleportation. Probably at least some of you have seen this before. So quantum teleportation is a quantum information protocol. You have Alice and Bob. They're widely separated. So let's say Alice is on Venus and Bob is on Mars. And she has a quantum system in a quantum state that she would like to transmit to Bob. The problem, however, is that they don't have any means of transmitting quantum systems to each other. All they have is a classical communication channel. So they have a classical telephone line. They can talk to each other, but they can't send photons through that transmission line. And the question is, can Alice send the state to Bob? Well, at first sight, it seems obvious that they can't. They only have classical channel, so she would somehow have to convert the quantum state to classical information. Since she doesn't know what the state is, the only way she could convert it to classical information would be to measure it somehow. But there's certainly no measurement that will reliably tell her what the quantum state is. Otherwise, you'd have a violation of the no cloning theorem. So at best, what she could do is make some measurement, tell Bob what she learned, and then he would be able to use that to reconstruct his best guess of psi, which would be some very noisy copy which only contains some information. So that's what it seems to be the case, but the point is that if Alice and Bob also happen to share an entangled state, so they have two systems, Alice has some other system A prime, and Bob has a system B, if they have pre-shared an entangled state, then they can do this by Alice just sending two classical bits to Bob. So the way this protocol works is that Alice and Bob have this pre-shared entangled state. Alice makes some joint measurement, which is called a Bell basis measurement. I'll explain in a minute. She makes a joint measurement of her system A, of the system that's in the unknown state, and her half of the entangled state. That measurement has four outcomes. So she's going to transmit the outcome of the measurement to Bob, which takes two bits of communication because it's four possibilities. And then based on that, Bob can apply some operation to his half of the entangled state, and that will result in the original state popping out on system B. Okay, so the way this works is the entangled state that they pre-share is this one that we've seen before. And then the protocol works like this. So Alice performs a joint measurement of her system A and the system A prime in this basis. So this is a basis of four entangled states. I have phi plus or minus and psi plus or minus. They form a complete orthonormal basis. She's going to get one of four outcomes. Alice communicates that to Bob. Depending on the outcome, Bob will now apply one of four unitary operations to his qubit, and this has the effect of transforming his qubit to the state psi b. a Phi-B. Phi? Psi-B, yeah, okay. This is how this works. So let's suppose that the unknown state is just some arbitrary state in the 0-1 basis. Then the initial state of the three systems is just the unknown state and the maximally entangled state here. And now the point is that I can just multiply, I'm just going to multiply out this tensor product. So I've got 3-qubit state. And now I'm going to rewrite this state. I'm going to pull out the basis states for AA prime. So I'm going to write the AA prime system in the basis that it's being measured in. And if you do that, you get this, these four terms, and it's not too hard to verify that if you multiply all this out, you get the original state that you had. So what you can see is that, so if Alice gets one of these, if Alice gets one of these four measurement outcomes, then Bob's state will collapse to these four systems, these four states. And you can see that if she gets the phi plus outcome here, then Bob's system is already in the state psi that we want. But if she gets one of these other three outcomes, then it's not quite the right state, but there is a unitary operation he can do to get back to the state he wants. So if Alice gets this outcome, for example, then Bob has to change the phase from minus to plus on state one. But he can do that from a unitary transformation if he knows that this is the outcome he needs. Right? So another way of writing this is to just say that you've got these four basis states, and then corresponding to each of these four basis states, there's some Bob's state is unitarily related to the state that he wants. And these are the four unitaries. Okay. In the case where it's phi plus, it's just the identity, so it's nothing. But okay. So if you look at if we consider the case where Alice gets the phi plus outcome, and we take the partial inner product here with phi plus, then what we get on Bob's system is just this. Okay, this state has norm a quarter, so that tells you that outcome will occur with probability 1/4, regardless of what Alice's initial state was. When she gets that outcome, Bob's state is basically this one, so he has to basically just imply the inverse of that unitary, which in this case is just the identity. And because all of these matrices are actually real, the adjoint is the same as the transpose, so he applies either the dagger or the transpose of that matrix. And then he attains Psi-B, but the same is true for the other three outcomes. Okay, so in the other three outcomes, we have non-trivial unitary matrices to apply. Okay. Any questions about how that works? Okay, so is teleportation a weird phenomena? Well, it depends. So if we consider, now let's consider the psiontic view of quantum states. So imagine we're dealing with a theory in which the quantum state is really a state of reality. It's a property of the quantum system, just like the positional momentum of a classical particle. Then we see that the unknown state which Alice sends to Bob is specified by two complex numbers which can take a continuum of possible values. So if you want to specify that precisely, it requires an infinite number of bits, right? If you believe in the psiontic view, then you think that the true state of reality contains all this information. So somehow an infinite amount of information in teleportation is being sent from Alice to Bob. So Alice is transmitting an infinite amount of information from Alice to Bob. But in reality, Alice is only sending 2 bits of information to Bob. She only sends 2 classical bits of information through the telephone line. So the question is, how did an infinite amount of information get transmitted from Alice to Bob when she only actually sent 2 bits of information to Bob? So some people have even suggested that to account for this, we have to think that the information went backwards in time, because if you look at this diagram, you could imagine, well, these are qubits, so they contain an infinite amount of information as well, right? So you could imagine that the information somehow travels along this path. But that's kind of a bit of an outlandish explanation, but some people have suggested that. But now let's consider the psi epistemic view. So in the view that, if you take the view that quantum states are something more like classical probability distributions, it really isn't so weird. So again, if I take a classical probability distribution, some probability p for heads, 1 minus p for tails, for a classical bit, this is also specified by a continuous parameter. So it would take an infinite number of bits to specify p precisely. But of course, Alice can transmit this probability distribution to Bob just by sending one bit, right? So if you have a coin flip, which comes up heads or tails, Alice just sends that coin flip to Bob. And if it was generated according to this probability distribution, it will still have that probability distribution when it arrives at Bob's side. And the reason why they can do that is because these parameters don't describe the state of reality, but only our knowledge of reality. In reality, there's just a bit, heads or tails. But this continuous parameter is just about what Alice and Bob know about that one bit. So that's not puzzling. In fact, you can do a protocol, you can do something else, you can do a protocol which looks a lot like teleportation. So here's how that would work. So Alice and Bob share now two bits. One bit is Alice's and one bit's Bob, and they're perfectly correlated. So they're generated in such a way, basically what you do is you flip a coin and you write down the outcome twice, send one of those copies to Alice, one of those copies to Bob. But then you'll have two bits that are perfectly correlated, and they have both have probability half of being either 0 or 1. Now Alice brings in another bit which has an unknown probability distribution. That's the one that she wants to send to Bob. And all she does is check whether her two bits are the same or different. Each possibility will happen with probability a half, because these correlated bits are either both the same or they're both the same, they're either both 0 or both 1. If her two bits are the same, then she also knows that Bob's bit is the same as her unknown bit, right? So she can just tell Bob, oh, they were the same, and then he does nothing, and he has a copy of her unknown bit. If she finds that they're different, then she knows also that Bob's bit is also different from the unknown bit, and so she just tells Bob, oh, they were different, so he flips his bit from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0. And now Bob will have a bit that's in exactly the same state as Alice's unknown bit with the same probabilities. Okay, this looks a lot like kind of teleportation. You have some correlated state between Alice and Bob. She makes some joint measurement. She doesn't even have to learn the value of the bits. She can put it into a machine which just tells her whether they're the same or different. So what you might call this classical teleportation protocol, it has a name. It's called the one-time pad or Vernon cipher. And it's a way that Alice can transmit information to Bob securely if they share correlated random bits. Because the point is that the information that Alice sends to Bob contains no information about the actual value of the bit. It just tells her whether it's the same or different from their correlated bits. So, and any eavesdropper who doesn't know the value of the correlated bits that they have doesn't get any information about what's transmitted. okay. This is also analogous to quantum teleportation, by the way, because in quantum teleportation, all the possible measurement outcomes just occur with probability a quarter and contain no information about what Alice's unknown state was. So quantum teleportation is also a secure way of sending quantum states from Alice to Bob. in any case, the point is, if you think of these two things as analogous, then on the psi epistemic view, were it the case that a qubit really only contains two bits of information in some sense, and the rest of the parameters are only expressing knowledge, something like classical probabilities, then there'll be no mystery here, right? Alice sends two bits to Bob, and if the state of reality, whatever it is, contains only two bits of information, if somehow a qubit contains only two bits of information, then there's no mystery here. Okay, so this would be the basic idea. Somehow, if a qubit really only contains a finite amount of information, then this kind of analogy would work out well. We will see next week that there are quite a few obstacles to this idea, but that's for later in the course. So are there any questions about any of that before we move on? Okay. All right, so I'm going to move on to the next section, and what I'm going to do is, so the next thing we want to do in the course is really talk about more about the mathematical foundations of quantum mechanics. So we want to, I'm going to at least review some of the generalized formalism of density operators, completely positive maps, and so forth that you've seen in quantum mechanics. But I'm going to try and do it in a slightly different way from what you've seen. And in order to do that, I'm going to introduce a different mathematical language. So I'm going to do a section on a sort of diagrammatic mathematical language that we can use to prove things in quantum mechanics, which is really the notion of string diagrams here. So these diagrams are their use in quantum foundations and quantum information has really been promoted by the group in Oxford of Bob Kirker and collaborators. And there's a textbook on it, which is called Quantum Picturalism by Kirker and Kissinger. I believe we've got a copy in the library. So if you find that you like this kind of approach, there's a whole textbook that you can read. But basically, this is a mathematics part, and I'm going to use this mathematics later to simplify some of the constructions that we have to do when talking about the generalized formalism. Okay. So I'm going to start slowly, but we're going to go through this probably quite quickly in general. Okay, so this is just to review some notions. So in quantum mechanics, pure states of a quantum system are kets. They're vectors in some vector space. Any vector space has a dual vector space. The dual vector space is the space of functionals from vectors to scalars, complex numbers in this case. Okay, so a dual vector is just a function which takes a vector and gives you a complex number. Okay, so a dual vector, which is these bra vectors, acts linearly on vectors. It's a linear functional, right? So it preserves linearity. And then we can define what we mean by taking a linear combination of two dual vectors, just in this way, just the linear combination of what you would get from each vector. And if we define linear combinations of dual vectors in this way, then the dual vectors themselves become a vector space. So this vector space is denoted V dagger, and that's called the dual vector space. Okay. So a ket is, if a ket is a vector, then a bra in Dirac notation really denotes a vector in the dual vector space. this is mostly review, but you might not have seen it in exactly this way. So if we have a Hilbert space, that means that in addition to it being a vector space, we also have an inner product. If we have an inner product, then there's an isomorphism between the Hilbert space and its dual. Okay, so this basically means that the vector space of the space of vectors and the space of dual vectors are essentially the same vector space. We can turn kets into bras as we're used to doing. So this is the way you can do it. So if I have a vector psi, I can define a dual vector by saying the action of psi on phi is what I get by taking the inner product of vector psi with phi. Okay, and this is And Dirac notation deliberately makes this distinction between dual vectors and inner products sort of a bit opaque, because that's why we use Dirac notation, right? So we can think of a dual vector as the action of the inner product, as taking the inner product of two vectors. Okay, and we can go the other way. So if you give me a dual vector, then let's take an orthonormal basis for the vector Hilbert space. Then I can define components GJ by acting with the dual vector on J. And then I can define a vector G, a vector version of G, just by taking these as basically the components. So there's two sort of notational things that are going on here. First of all, I've put this as an upper index. Later on, I'm going to generally make the rule in this section that vectors are going to have upper indices and dual vectors will have lower indices, like you may be familiar with in differential geometry for general relativity, if you've done that. And so this upper index G dagger is just, its value is just the complex conjugate of this lower index G that we defined here. And it's fairly straightforward to prove that this is an isomorphism. So if I start with a vector here, make a dual vector, and then go back via this construction, I get back to the same vector that I started with. Okay. All right. So this we've seen before. So if we have an orthonormal basis for two Hilbert spaces, we can define the tensor product. It's just the object that looks like this, all possible combinations of basis vectors with components. So the tensor product is a Hilbert space, and it inherits its inner product from the two components. So basically, if I have two tensor product states, then I determine the inner product on the tensor product space just by taking a linear combination of the inner products on the individual spaces, right? So this is sort of the only way of generating the tensor product on generating the inner product on the tensor product space that's compatible with the inner products on the individual spaces and is appropriately linear. Okay. So that's how we take inner products. All right, so in notation, it's going to get cumbersome to always use Dirac notation, because we're going to end up having to take heap track of long strings of kets and bras and things like that. Already this is looking a bit cumbersome. So what we can do is develop a sort of abstract index notation similar to what gets used in general relativity. So if we basically think about what's the information contained in here, it's what are the components in this basis, and also that it's subsystem A, right? So I can just replace this notation by a notation like this, where I have JA is an index that refers to some system A. So I can write a vector as an sort of abstract object with an upper index like this, and a dual vector as an object with a lower index like that. And then if I'm taking an inner product, I'll just write it like this. And here we had, let's see, what was it? No, let's be on this slide. Yeah, so here we have a summation, but you can see that we can just, if we adopt the summation convention, so whenever there's an upper index and a lower index that's the same, then I don't need to write a summation sign here. Okay, so unlike what you're used to from general relativity, where the indices always run over four possible values for space-time, here it's going to be necessary to label the indices with the label of the Hilbert space, because Hilbert spaces might have different dimensions. I might be looking at the tensor product of a qubit and a three-dimensional system. And then it's important to know that you can't contract the index of a qubit with the index of a three-dimensional system. Okay, so only upper A indices can be contracted with lower A indices, but the system label has to match. Okay, so let's look at the example of a tensor product space. If we had like a tensor product space, then here's, we have a two-index tensor here, two upper indices, and we have a dual vector here, so we have two lower indices, and then the inner product just would be contract both of these indices, right? But bear in mind that an object like this here, where I contract the second index of this with the first index of that, is not allowed because I can't contract an A index with a B index. I can only contract indices that have the same Hilbert space. Any questions on that so far? All right, so that's the notation. And now I'm going to introduce a third notation, throwing some notations at you. So even these abstract tensors can get tedious after a while. So we will represent them with diagrams as well. So a tensor is represented by a box. So something with any number of indices is going to be represented by a box. If it has a vector index, an index that refers to the fundamental Hilbert space, then that gets represented by a line that comes upwards out of the box. And a dual vector, so something that corresponds to a dual vector index, will be represented by a downward directed line. And then contraction is just represented by joining. Wow. PowerPoint just crashed. What? What? Seems to be loading everything I've ever. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, and when we contract, wow. Microsoft PowerPoint stopped working. I know it did. Okay, let's see. All right. Please work this time. Okay, so let's give some examples. So if I just have a vector in the fundamental space of one index, abstract index notation is like this, and the diagrammatic notation is just a box. It's a label psi to remind me that it came from state psi. And because I have a vector index, I just have one index coming up, and I put on that line a label that tells me it refers to system A. Similarly, the dual vector that has a lower index in abstract index notation, and it's a box with a line coming down the bottom. And if I'm going to do an inner product like this, that's a contraction of these two indices. And I'll just do it, I'll just notate it by connecting the two lines of the two boxes. A bit more sophisticated, so now we have a tensor product of two systems. This would have now two indices, so I have two lines, two different labels. Here is a dual vector in that space, and here's what their inner product looks like. Okay, so now, note that the shape of the box doesn't matter. It's only the direction of the lines coming out of it that tells me what kind of tensor it is, right? So I could, if I like, so this is a a vector tensor product of two vector spaces has two upward indices. I could, if I like, draw the box any shape I want, as long as it has two upward lines coming out of it. They all represent the same thing. Okay, so let's now look at some more interesting kinds of tensor products. So the Hilbert space A and the dual Hilbert space of B, they're both Hilbert spaces. And I can take the tensor product of any two Hilbert spaces. There's no reason why I can't consider HA tensor the dual of HB. Okay, so this is a vector space of objects of this form, right? It has one component which is from a vector space, one component which is from a dual vector space. So it has one upper index and one lower index. And in abstract index notation, it looks like this. And as a diagram, it looks like this. It has one vector index and one dual vector index. Now let's consider the dual space to this. The dual space to this is just, you know, I take the dagger of HA tensor HB dagger, it'll be the dual space on A and the regular vector space on B. So that's an object that looks like this. It has, again, one vector index and one dual vector index, but the point is that the labels are swapped. B is now the vector index, and J is the dual vector index. So that looks like this, or I could equivalently write it like this. It only matters that A is a downward pointing line and B is an upward pointing line. And in this case, it's useful to write it like this, because if we want to take the inner product, which is just going to be contract all the indices, then it has to be like this. I need to connect this A line to this A line and this B line to that B line. Okay. All right, so does this make sense so far? Right, so this object here, it isn't either a pure ket or a pure bra. However, it is still just a Hilbert space, just like any other, right? So sometimes in the future, it's going to be useful to think of that. So the point is, I can define any Hilbert space I like to be my sort of fundamental space of kets, right? My fundamental space of vectors. So sometimes it's useful to just think of this object itself as the sort of fundamental space that we're dealing with. And so think of the space of vectors in here as my kets, and its dual as my space of bras. So when I'm doing that, I'm going to use red bra kets and red diagrams, right? So the translation is like this. If I'm thinking of this as a space of kets and this as a space of bras, then you would write it like this. But it is just a vector in the red convention. In the red convention, that's just the space of kets. And I would write it like this. in the diagrammatic language, this kind of procedure is sometimes called doubling. And what it does, what you'll see later, what it does is it makes the diagrams look more like operationally what you do in the lab to implement these operations. But that's coming later. All right, so clearly you can iterate this as much as you like and consider any complicated combination of tensor products that you like. So here I've got like three dual spaces and two regular spaces, and that corresponds to an object like this, which in abstract index notation looks like this. And then it just has two vector indices and three dual vector indices. And its dual vector space, just take daggers of everything like this. It has three vector spaces and two dual vector spaces, and just the indices are the opposite way around. Okay? And then whenever you have two such objects, you can contract them to form, to take an inner product. You contract them, and then you get just a number. Okay? So this is very intuitive how this generalizes. Okay, so now we can consider also partial inner products. We've considered them before. It's like when you have a maximally entangled state, for instance, and you only measure Alice as part of that, you're basically doing a partial inner product where you only contract indices on Alice's side. But we can do this in general. So if we consider two arbitrary tensors like this, they have some matching indices, right? So I've got a B dagger here and a B, so those can be contracted, and I've got a C and a C dagger, those can be contracted, but A and D cannot be contracted because they have different labels. But I can form a contraction like this, which is going to give me a tensor which has a one vector label for A and one dual vector label for D. And diagrammatically, it's much simpler what it looks like. I just connect the C and B legs together. And then I get an object like this. OK. All right, so now things are going to get fun. So now let's consider the space of linear operators from HA to HB, right? HA and HB might have different dimensions. So we're not necessarily talking about square matrices here. It might have a different number of rows than columns. So the space of linear operators from HA to HB, I'm going to denote by L HA to HB. And if it happens that I'm dealing with square matrices where the input and output Hilbert spaces are the same, I'll just write it as L HA. So in Dirac notation, you're familiar with the idea that you can write an operator in terms of its matrix elements like this. Okay, these are the matrix elements of the operator. But if you stare at that for a minute, you're like, well, apart from the fact that there's no tensor product symbol here, this looks exactly the same thing, same as an object in the tensor product of HB and the dual space of HA. Right? Such an object looks like this in abstract index notation and like this as a diagram. And it's suggestive, right? It's like, oh, this looks like an input, and that looks like an output, which is what you should have for an operator. So indeed, those are the same thing. We can treat an operator as an element of this tensor product, the tensor product of the dual of the input space with output space. And the action of the operator is then just a partial inner product, right? So if we take this object in this tensor product here, and if we take a vector on system A, then the action of this operator is supposed to be given by this, just matrix multiplication. But that's exactly what you get from the partial inner product of this object with that, contracting the A indices. So an operator from A to B is an object in the tensor product of the dual space of A with B. Those are the same things. So in general, the space of linear operators is the same thing. I mean, it's really isomorphic too, but in Dirac notation, it looks just exactly the same. Take the dual of the input space, tensor product with the output space, that's the same thing as the linear operators from HA to HB. So you can do everything in quantum mechanics. Don't worry about operators. You can do everything with tensor products of systems and partial inner products. And notice that this space, HB tensor HA dagger, which is the linear operators, is just what I introduced earlier as the red kets, right? So when I'm talking about red kets, I mean, let's treat operators, the space of linear operators, as our fundamental set of vectors. That's what that's doing. All right, how are we doing for time? We're going fast for this. This is not standard terminology, but I'm silly, so I like to make this. So if we think of an operator is a linear function. Oh wait, sorry. Yeah. So an operator from A to B. If we consider what's the dual space of the operators, it will be a linear functional from operators to scalars, right? So I sometimes called the dual of an operator, a duperator. It's the dual of an operator. But it's just another set of operators, because if I take the dual of this space, it's just HA tensor HB dagger, which is isomorphic to the operators from B to A. So the dual of the operators from A to B is just the operators from B to A, right, like this. So you can say the duperators from A to B are just the operators from B to A. Okay. So if we have an operator from A to B, it's written like this and like this in the Redcat language. Now if I have a duperator from A to B, a duperator from A to B is a dual vector in the red space. I might write it like this to emphasize, you know, when I write it like an operator, you usually have bra followed by ket. To emphasize that I'm thinking of this as a dual of an operator, I put the ket here and the bra there, keep the ordering of the systems the same. To emphasize that this kind of thing is supposed to act on this. It's just, however, an operator from B to A, but here I'm thinking of it as a dual vector on the A to B space. Okay. So in a product of operators, well, we just got a general correspondence between vectors and duals. So So there's a correspondence between vectors and duals. I don't know why I did this. Anyway, just as with any inner product space, given an operator, given an operator from A to B, I can define an operator from B to A just by taking the dual, just by taking the correspondence to the duals given by the inner product. Then the inner product between two vectors is just given in this way, just by contracting, contract the operator with the dual of the other operator. So the inner product on the space of operators, if you do that, gives you this, which is just the trace. If you think of these as matrices, it's just the trace of the product of those matrices. So because this is inherited from the fundamental inner product on the individual spaces, without proof, you can prove it directly, but without proof, you already know that this thing here must be an inner product on the space of operators. And it's usually called the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm a bit confused about the advantage of introducing this red diagram. Because
the red
if
represent.
You have more than one bra hyperspace or kit hyperspace, you will still write it this way?
The point of the red representation will become much clearer later. Because the point is that in general, a state of a quantum system is a density operator, right? So in this kind of language, diagrammatic language, it has an input and an output. But if you want diagrams which look like what you're doing in the lab, then you want to represent that as a state preparation. So you want to represent it as something with just a line that comes out the top. So by viewing the operators as your fundamental ket space, if you like, then you end up translating into diagrams that look like what you do in the lab. See what I mean? That'll probably become much clearer later. Okay, 5 minutes. Let's at least get to the punch here. So this is the cool bit. Okay. Now let's consider this vector. This vector here is a maximally entangled state, except unnormalized. There's no normalization here. So I'm just calling this delta. The reason I'm calling this delta is because its components in this basis are just Kronecker delta function. Okay. So this is an object in the Hilbert space HA tensor HA. In abstract index notation, it's just going to be a delta function. But we're going to introduce a diagrammatic notation for this, which is just this U-shaped wire. Why do we do that? Because if you take the partial inner product of a vector with this, sorry, of a dual vector, take the partial inner product of a dual vector with this, then I get a vector. It acts as a raising operator. So diagrammatically, we want to be able to see that we take something that's a dual vector and turn it into a vector, and that's what happens if I have this kind of representation here, right? So that's the diagrammatic notation for that. Similarly, I can define this dual vector, which has Kronecker delta components, and that's going to do the opposite thing. It's going to turn kets into bras. So abstract notation, I have lower indices. Diagrammatic notation, it's like this cap thing. So this acts as a lowering operator, and it does this diagrammatically. And then finally, there's another one, which is if I have mixed, if one of these is a vector space and one of them is a dual vector space, then I've got the identity operator that also has components, JK, that also has components Kronecker delta, but they're an upper and a lower index. And as a diagram, we're going to represent that as a vertical piece of wire, because it's easy to see that if I multiply this by any vector, basically does nothing to the vector. It's the identity operator. Okay, so here's the cool thing. These various delta tensors that I've introduced satisfy these axioms. And by the way, if you would like to develop all of this math purely diagrammatically without ever introducing the vector space, you can basically take these and a few other things as the axioms for doing that. But so here are the axioms. So these are called the Yanking axioms. So if I have a curved piece of wire like this, I can basically pull it straight. So if you think of this as a piece of string, you can pull it straight. And you can see that that's true, because if I contract these two indices here, then what that does is it raises, raising or lowering one of the indices, and you end up with the identity. And similarly over here. So I can yank these. They're called the yanking axioms because you can yank the string straight, basically. Then these axioms are usually also imposed, but this basically says that the order that you write down your indices in doesn't matter. That's all that this really says, that these axioms really say. So this loop, this shouldn't think of this as a point where they're attached. You should think of it as crossing the wires crossing each other. So this just expresses the fact that the order of indices isn't important in the abstract index notation. Okay, maybe I'll just do this one. So this allows us to define a notion of a transpose. So the transpose of an operator is. So generally, I'm not going to bother putting a T here. We'll introduce some notation that makes it explicit. The point is that if I take a tensor and just raise all the lowered indices and lower all the raised indices, that's the transpose. That's what we mean by the transpose. For an operator, it just really means switching the order of rows and columns. And so diagrammatically, the transpose is defined as just all these raising and lowering operators like this. Now here's a piece of diagrammatic fun that we can do to make this transparent. We can make this more intuitive in diagrams if we introduce a bit of asymmetry to our boxes. So instead of having square boxes, I'm going to have a box with like one side is sloped. Why do I do that? Because then instead of writing this transpose here, I can denote the transpose as just 180 degree rotation of this box. Because if you imagine again that these wires are pieces of string, if I hold on to these pieces of string and pull them straight, then this box would rotate by 180 degrees. So the notation for the transpose is just going to be, if I apply all these raising and lowering here, that's the same thing diagrammatically as rotating the box 180 degrees. I think I'm going to have to stop there because we're out of time, but we're going to have some fun with these diagrams at the beginning of next time before I get into the talking about the generalized formalism. Any questions? Yeah.
I'm wondering the intuition of introducing these pictures for quantum process, because I think I can't imagine how Bob come up with this idea.
Well, I mean, I don't think, but first of all, I don't think he came up with all of these ideas. Some of these things have a long history, going back to, you know, the idea of representing tensors diagrammatically has a long history. You know, Roger Penrose did it, and various other people. But there, you know, the sort of formal semantics of it is due to the Oxford group. What's the intuition behind it? I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that question, but once you've got it, once you've got the notion of string diagrams, then a lot of, see, when you're proving things about the formalism of quantum mechanics, you often have to end up doing a lot of fancy gymnastics with indices, swapping indices, moving them around, and this kind of thing. And it gets very complicated and easy to lose track. When you have these diagrams, it's straightforward to see what you can do, to see what you can do that will keep the equation the same. So I personally think that when you're sort of introducing the mathematics of completely positive maps or whatever, it becomes enormously clearer if you have these diagrams available. Not everybody does it that way, but I think it helps. But anyway, at the beginning of next time, we'll see like some examples of things you can prove easily using the diagrams. Okay, see you tomorrow then.